Hey, this is Hojo, and you're listening to me on Baseball and Barbecue with my two best friends, my new best friends, Jeff and Leonard. So y'all enjoy it, okay?
Studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 193 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Old Coot Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman. We welcome you back to our episode, Leonard.
Jeff, 193.
Yes, getting closer to that magical number 200.
Yes, we got big plans, but let's not give that away. But I'm just going to say big plans.
So who do we have on this episode?
Ah, it's a good one because we have Ira Burko. He wrote 26 books other than this. He's a major columnist for the New York Times. But this book that we had him on for is Baseball's Best Ever, A Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers. And these are all articles that he has written, stories that he has written. Okay, we'll get to him in a second. I'm just so excited about him. But Jeff, who's our barbecue guest?
Ralph Perazzo.
From?
Snapperazzo Hot Dogs?
That is correct. And what goes better in a baseball game than a hot dog?
Hot dog, yeah. He has some fantastic hot dogs that we got to taste over at Pig Beach when we went there in April.
Yeah, so we'll talk you all about that. But first, let's tell you that BetOnline is your number one source for all your betting needs. Get the latest odds, lines, and matchup reports for baseball, boxing, golf, and more. BetOnline continues to be the fastest and easiest way to place your wagers, including live betting and your favorite casino and card games available to play right from your phone. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today and get in on the action. Remember to use promo code BLEAV, that's BLEAV, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, it is where the game starts.
All right. You know, Len, you said that this one was going to be a good one. Well, last week was a good one. And the week before that was a good one. And the week before that was a good one.
What? So one day I'm just going to say, this one sucks.
You know, you remind me of Steve Harvey on Family Feud when he says, you know, we have a good one for you today. Well, he says it every single game, you know?
You're right. I got to change my tune. I got to change my tune. But if I was Steve Garvey, Steve Garvey is not my Padre. Remember that?
Yes.
Remember that shirt? Uh-huh. When he went to San Diego.
Ira Burko is a fantastic writer. I mean, he's an all-time great writer.
He was terrific. I mean, this book is gold. It's gold, Jerry. It's gold. I really think everyone's going to enjoy it. Let's get right to it. Let's get to Ira Burko.
Ira Burko. For over a quarter century, our guest was a sports reporter for the New York Times. He's also written for the Chicago Tribune Magazine, Reader's Digest, and Sports Illustrated. Among his distinguished career, he's won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for national reporting on his article, The Minority Quarterback. Inducted into the International Jewish Sports Hall of Fame in 2009 and holds an honorary doctorate from Roosevelt University in Chicago. Among his many books are Wrigley Field, an oral and narrative history of the home of the Chicago Cubs, It Happens Every Spring, DiMaggio, Mays, The Splendid Splinter, and A Lifetime at the Ballpark, Hank Greenberg, The Story of My Life, Pitches Do Get Only, Summers in the Bronx, Attila the Hun, and Other Yankee Stories, and his latest, Baseball's Best Ever, A Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers. Side note, he also writes about other sports other than baseball. Tremendously honored to have with us Ira Burkow. Welcome, Ira.
Nice to be with you. And that recitation tired me out. I can't believe I had that energy to do that stuff.
Ira,
a number of years ago.
You've written over 26 books. I was afraid Jeff might mention every one, and we like, okay.
Well, I was waiting for you.
Ira, this is such a fantastic book, a half century covering Hall of Famers. This is just, I just loved reading the book and learning about all these famous people, all these baseball players. But first, I want to ask you about someone who's not a Hall of Famer, and that is your autograph for Hard Rock Johnson. I mean, a baseball from Hard Rock Johnson.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Chicago, and I was I lived on the west side, midway between Comiskey Park for the White Sox and Wrigley Field for the Cubs. But I started following baseball, can you believe this, in 1948 when I was 8 years old. And the Cubs had just been in a World Series in 1945, and the Yankees and the White Sox hadn't been in a World Series since 1919, and they threw that one. And so most of the people in my neighborhood were Cub fans, and so I became a Cub fan. We'd go to the games, and on the west side, we never paid to go into a game. We would sneak in various ways. And then sometimes after games, we would wait to get autographs from the ball players. We knew where they came down. One of the coaches for the Cubs was Hard Rock Johnson, Roy Hard Rock Johnson, who had a very brief major league career, but he was a coach with the Cubs, and he was kind of a tough character. I asked him for his autograph. He was getting into a car, and he said, "Come back to tomorrow, and I'll give you a ball. See, I can't give you an autograph right now." So I believed him. The next day, I came with my friends, and I said, "Hard Rock Johnson promised me a baseball." I was 11 years old. He said, "Hard Rock Johnson promised you a baseball." He said, "He's not going to give you a baseball, you idiot." And so I said, "But I'm going to try." So I went down from the grandstands right to the boxes, and he was fumbling out balls to the outfielders before the game. And so I started calling. I said, Mr. Johnson, you promised me a baseball. Well, he ignored me. And then I persisted. And finally, I guess he just got disgusted with me, and he turned and he tossed me a ball. Now, it wasn't one of the shiny balls either. He tossed me the ball, and I ran back with the ball and my friends wanted to look at it. And I said, "I'm not letting this out of my hands. I don't know what they were going to do with it." So, but anyway, I kept it, I put it in my pocket, and I came home, and friends said, "You can clean up the ball by putting it in a dish of milk." And so I put the ball in a dish of milk for a day, and then I took it out, and it not only was it not clean, I mean, it was now yellow from the milk and soggy, and that was Hard Rock Johnson's ball. But I took it, and then a day or two later, I went to Hard Rock Johnson, and I said, "This is the ball you tossed me. Would you give an autograph on it?" And he said, "I gave it to you to play with. I didn't give it to you for an autograph." And we did play with it, with that soggy ball. he endeared me. Hard Rock Johnson endeared me.
That's a great story.
Ira, it's an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you. The book, Baseball's Best Ever, A Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers, as Jeff said, it's, I can't put it down, which is a problem because I have a day job. So, but I want to go to the fact that you are a little bit of a thief. Let's go back to continue when you were a kid. And if you could tell us the story about the time you and your buddy stole a glove.
My buddy stole a glove.
Okay. you were just an accomplice.
Yeah. I mean, we would sneak into the games well before the gates opened up. And I mean, the west side of Chicago, it was the west side of Chicago. I mean, Capone had his headquarters there. So we would go to the games and we would sneak into the games. And this one particular time, the gates were closed, but we were able to get in through the vendor's gate. And then we went down into to the Cubs dugout. And so the two of us are sitting. I was 12 and my friend was 14. And we were sitting in the dugout watching the Cubs take a batting practice. And some of the other players were out fielding and waiting to take their turn batting. And Hank Sauer, who was the star left fielder for the Cubs and an all-star player, so he came in to take his batting practice, and he tossed his glove, which he was using in left field, tossed it on the bench, sitting, it was right by me. Oh my God, Hank Sauer's glove. Hank Sauer was such a hero. And so I picked up the glove and I just, I patted it and I patted the pocket. And then my friend, who was much older than me by 2 years, he was 14, I was 12. And he said, let me see the glove. So of course, so I gave him the glove. He took the glove, he was wearing a sweater. He took the glove, put it under his sweater and said, let's get out of here. I said, get out of here. This is Hank Sauer's glove. We can't take Hank Sauer's glove. Well, he ran out and I had to follow him. And we got on the elevated train to go back home. And he kept taking off one train and getting on another train. So because he thought maybe we're being followed. But this was his mentality. This was his mentality. And so I said, can't we should have stayed for the game, you know. But anyway, no. And so he played with that glove for years. And then it fell apart. Now it's 30 some years later, I guess. It was 1952, so now it's 1989. How many years is that? 30 something here, 40 years. I'm covering the World Series, in which the Giants are in the World Series against who were they? I forgot. Who
89 years.
Yeah. It was a bridge World right. Series, and so Sauer. Is now a scout for the San Francisco Giants. And so for all these years, from 1952 now to 1989, I was thinking, now I'm a professional writer, sports writer, that one day maybe I'll run into him and I'll make a confession. And in fact, in 1952, at the end of the season, he was MVP. Sport Magazine did a story on him. And he talked about his glove disappearing. And I was reading it in bed, the story in Sport Magazine, and guilt just filled me. I was feeling so guilty. And I just thought, okay, one day maybe I can run into him. So now the Giants are in the World Series, and he's a scout for the Giants. And that's when the earthquake happened. And then people are just all filing out of the Giants ballpark. And I'm filing out, too. And I was with Tom Callahan, who was then a sports editor of Time Magazine, and the two of us were leaving the ballpark and coming in the other direction and about to go down the ramp. There was that face that was so familiar to me. It was Hank Sauer. And so as he gets closer and about to go down the ramp, I said to Tom Callahan, I have to say something to that man, but I have to say it in private. And so he's with three other people, probably his wife and his son and daughter-in-law or vice versa. And so I said, but would you please talk to them? He's like, what can I say to them? I said, I don't know, but I have to talk to that man. And so I stopped them. And this is the middle of the earthquake. And Hank Sauer thinks I want his autograph. And he says, I can't sign anything. Right. I said, I have something very important to tell you. He said, what's that? I said, well, I have to tell you in private. And so we walk over to the side, and Tom Callahan is now, I don't know what he's saying to those three people, but he's keeping them away. And so I said, in 1952, your glove disappeared. He said, yeah. He said, of course, I remember, you know, my glove disappearing. And I always wondered what happened to it. Well, Hank, this is what happened to it. And I told him. And then he was a big guy with very big hands. And I said that my friend took the glove and we both ran out. And then, and he said, as people in the ballpark because of the quake, he said to me, you stole my glove. I said, Hank, I didn't do it. He had these big hands and he put his hands on my throat and he said, you stole my glove. Ooh. And I said, I didn't. And then he took his hands away. He smiled. And 2 years later, he was playing golf and he hit the ball on the first tee and he's going to hit a second shot, and he collapsed with a heart attack and died. Mm. And I was very sad about that. But yeah. I wrote at the time, I was a New York Times columnist, and I wrote the column about him.
Yeah, and you made your confession. That's good. The book is written in...
That was my confession.
Yeah.
Confession is good for the soul.
Yes.
Right. I wish I could have seen him another time. I would have bought him a dinner.
The book is called Baseball's Best Ever, A Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers. It's divided into really decades, although the first chapter is really two decades, the 30s to the 1903 to the 1920s. And in 1970, and it's really your articles that you all put into a book, correct?
Right.
They're all dated. And there's one here that really fascinated me. It's called The Great Honus Wagner Was Outplayed by Freddie Parent in the First World Series. And we all know who Honus Wagner is, one of the greatest players who ever played, all that. But this guy, Freddie Parent, who nobody ever heard of, I mean, we didn't know, he outplayed him. And he loved talking about it.
Well, yeah. Freddie Parent was a shortstop for the opposing team. They were called the Boston Patriots then. And Honus Wagner, of course, was with the Pirates. They both played shortstop. And Honus Wagner did not have a good... They played in the World Series. And Honus Wagner did not have a good World Series. But Freddie Parent was a major league shortstop. I mean, he was a good player. And he out-hit him. And he apparently outplayed him in the field. And Honus Wagner admitted it. But now... It's something like 1970 or 72 or 3, and Freddie Parent is the last living member who played in that World Series in 1903, the first World Series with the American and National Leagues, and he was the last player, and he was living in an old age home, a retirement home. I found out where he was, and it was now World Series time. And so I wanted to interview him, and I found out where he was. And it turned out that he couldn't talk on the phone because he couldn't hear on the phone. But so a nurse, one of the nurses there, sat with him. And then I asked her the question. She was able to ask Freddie Parent the question. And then he gave the answer, and then I got his answer. And so I really interviewed the nurse.
Right.
but Freddie Parent then was in his 90s and his brain was functioning. He was fine, but it turned out that he was the last living member who played or was on one of those two teams in the first World Series.
Yeah. And he loved talking about it too. He was like, you know, the way you wrote about it in the article, he was just a lot of joy talking about it.
Your stories have they're heartwarming. A lot of them, it's beyond just the ball player.
I can add one point to that Freddie Parent story that he had a cane, and the nurse said that he watches the baseball games. He loves watching the baseball games, and when something exciting happens, he hits his cane on the floor in excitement, and that's how he expressed his thrill of the game.
What I was going to say is you have something about Lefty Gomez and the great pitcher Lefty Gomez, and the last paragraph is just you are talking to his wife. This was after he passed away, and you write, "We had such a good time, all that laughter," she said, "even up to the end. In the hospital about a week ago, the doctor leaned over his bed and said, 'Lefty, picture yourself on the mound and rate the pain from 1 to 10 And Lefty looked at him and said, "Who's hitting, Doc?" I thought that was so good.
I don't remember that, and I'm delighted that you recalled it. So yeah, it was good. I mean, Lefty Gomez was funny. He was funny. He was a wonderful character, and of course, a great pitcher.
You know, I've told this story before. I was on a vacation, and I was at the Vatican. And our tour guide was a very religious woman who went to Mass every day. And she said, "If you want to, you can afterwards, you can shake the hand of a person who it was kissed by the Pope." She had gone to a Mass and he sat next to her. He would go to these Masses. I feel like as I'm reading this and we're talking to you, we're talking to the person who has... We're not interacting with these players, but reading the book and now talking to you, It's 1 degree of separation. So the career that you've had, Ira, but do you ever pinch yourself and just say, I spoke to this person and that person, and just does it ever hit you like the kind of career that you've had?
Well, I'm grateful for it. I never thought I'd be a writer. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. And then just quirky things happen along the way. And I just sort of fell into it. And but I had been a baseball fan, and I was knowledgeable about the history of the game. And maybe the oldest player that I talked with was Wade Hoyt, who was an announcer later for the Reds. But he pitched for the Red Sox when Babe Ruth was with the Red Sox. And Wade Hoyt was funny, and he's in the Hall of Fame, and he's in my book. But I knew the history, and so it was fun for me sometimes to go to some of the players. But even the modern players, I was just recalling to somebody, I was in the Yankee clubhouse. I was interviewing, I forgot who the player was that I was interviewing, but next to him was a locker, and the player who had that locker was not there. And so I was interviewing this player who was seated, and since no one was in the chair next to him, I took the chair and sat down as I'm interviewing him. And after a few minutes, I get a tap on the shoulder, and I look up, and it's one of the players. And he said, "That's my locker, and that's my chair you're sitting in." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I'll get up." And he said, "I brought you a chair," which was about the nicest thing anybody could ever do for a reporter in a clubhouse. And the pitcher was Al Leiter. And so I immediately became a huge Al Leiter fan. But you know, being around them, and I remember interviewing Maury Wills, and he was talking about race. And at one point, and I just couldn't, he was talking with such depth and such meaning that I had a reporter's notebook. It wasn't the phones yet. So I could not bring out my notebook to start taking notes as he's talking, so full from the heart. And must have talked for about 45 minutes. And I'm thinking to myself, you have to remember what this is, because this is good stuff. And so we finished talking. I left the clubhouse, I ran around the corner, and I started taking notes like crazy. Mm-hmm. And a strange thing happened with Maury Wills. And the strange thing was this. He was now with the Pittsburgh Pirates. He had left, he was at the end of his career. And he left the Dodgers, and he was the Pittsburgh Pirates. In spring training, the Pirates trained in Bradenton. I covered spring training. And so I went to see him. I went to see the Pirates, and I hadn't heard from Maury Wills after doing the story. And the story that I did was I introduced Maury Wills sitting on the bench in the dugout. And then I just quoted him from beginning to end. And I had not taken any notes. And but I took the notes after I left him, because I just didn't want to interrupt his conversation. It was just from the heart. I saw him, and he was sitting alone in the dugout, and I introduced myself. He said, I remember you. And there was no smile. There was no sense of recognition. And I'm thinking, what did I get wrong? Because I quoted him from beginning to end. I just introduced him sitting in his locker, and the quotes were from beginning to end, and I did not take a note. I said, I did a story on you. He said, I know. I saw it. And I said, were you unhappy with it? He said, yes. I said, did I misquote you? He said, no. I said, well, what was the problem? He said, you made me sound immodest. And all I was doing was quoting him, and his feelings about blacks. And he marched in Washington. There was a march, and he marched in Washington. And we just talked about all of this. And I thought, this is terrific stuff. And it shows that the dimensions of a ball player going beyond the ball field. Mm-hmm. And he said, You made me sound, I'll never forget the quote. He said, "You made me sound immodest." And I said, "I'd like to apologize for that, but I got it correctly.
All right. Speaking of race, yeah. You also spoke to Rod Carew when he was with the Twins, and Griffith was the owner of the Minnesota Twins. And they taking down a statue because he said some derogatory things when they were in the Washington Senators. Could you talk about Rod Carew and his feelings toward Calvin Griffith? Because I know they had a complicated relationship, I guess.
Yeah, but he like I did a book with Carew. I did Carew's autobiography, and I got to know Rod well. And he felt that Griffith treated him well, and he thought that if he was had racist beliefs or feelings, he didn't demonstrate them with him being Rod. Rod was a star. And so, and Rod was, he could be temperamental. He went along, he liked Calvin Griffith, and he felt Calvin Griffith treated him well. Doing the book with Carew, we went one day to play tennis, the two of us. And he was a great athlete, and I'm at best a mediocre tennis player, although I was captain of my high school basketball team in Chicago. But anyway, so we were playing, started to play. And at one point, he fell to the ground on his side. We were playing, and he fell to the ground. And I looked, and I was about to serve. And I looked over, and I said, "Rod, are you okay?" And he was laughing. And I said, "Rod, what happened? What's so funny?" He said, "Ira, you're trying so hard." And I guess I was, because he was beating me. And I thought, and he wasn't a tennis player, but he was a great athlete.
Yeah.
He could have done anything, So, but anyway, that was my tennis experience with Rod.
You also had interactions with Satchel Paige.
Yeah.
What was Satchel Paige? What was he like?
I met Satchel Paige after almost after his pitching career, because he came back one or two times to pitch a couple of innings when he was like 140 years old or something. to get his 5 years in and to get a pension from the major leagues, the Braves hired him as a coach. And so I spent some time with him in spring training, and he was a delight. But I remember him saying that he wished that he had been the first Black in the major leagues. He eventually was, Robinson was in 40, Jackie was in 47, and then Satchel Paige came along in 48. And he may have been the eighth or ninth Black player at that time in the major leagues. It was Hank Thompson and, some others, Newcomb, I think. He said, but it was best that that I wasn't the first, and that Jackie was able to handle all that guff about racism. He said, I wouldn't have been able to handle it, and I would have been fighting back. And Branch Rickey told Robinson to not fight back for this season and maybe next season. The season after, you're on your own. And that's when Jackie took up arms, really. But I remember that poignant moment with Satchel Paige, and he was very thin, and I remember that he crossed his legs, and it reminded me of a flamingo with long skinny legs, and that was Satchel, and he was a sweetheart.
Yeah,
and you have a column in there about I believe it's Nolan Ryan. When Nolan Ryan was about 30, he met Satchel, and Satchel told him to throw a bow tie.
Oh yeah, yeah, a bow tie. And Nolan Ryan said, "What bow tie pitch? What's a bow tie pitch?" And he said, "You throw it up by their chin to move them off the plate." I don't know if Nolan Ryan needed that bow tie, but he was aware of it after Satchel explained it to him.
There's no way that a baseball fan, there is just no way that they can resist this book. I mean, How do I say that this book is like crack for a baseball fan? It's just the stories are it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It really is just Ira, that it's just everyone seems better than the other. I mean, I'm working on No Sleep because I wanted to make sure that I had this thing finished for the interview, but then it wasn't difficult because I could not put it down. It's because it's beyond just, you know, this player did this, this player did that. These are beautiful stories.
Yeah.
Really.
And who knew that Ted Williams' commander in World War II was John Glenn? I mean, that's a great tidbit. I mean, that was fantastic. And you go on and talk about Joe DiMaggio. You actually had the chutzpah to ask him about Marilyn Monroe. I know he's very famous, very close. Don't say anything, but you did. It was very, very poignant way you did it too. It was very good.
Yeah. He wasn't going to tell anybody, but he tried for some reason. We had previous experiences together, and he trusted me, and then so. He didn't talk about Marilyn Monroe to anybody, you know, but he did say to me, well, she was a, I said, there was a picture of the two of you getting off of the plane on your honeymoon in Tokyo. And I said, she really looked great. And he looked at me and he said, as this, he was going to give me some inside secret. And he said, she was a beautiful woman. I said, well, I have to agree. but, you know, it reminds me of you're wearing that Yogi Berra cap. And one of my favorite stories about Yogi is I was covering the Hall of Fame induction weekend, one weekend. I was with Steve Jacobson, who was a columnist for Newsday at the time. We were all going to get on the bus to take us to the field where the induction ceremony was going to be held. And we were talking with Yogi Berra, who was going to get on the bus with us. And Steve had a baseball. And so, and Steve said, Yogi, I'd like you to sign, autograph this baseball for me. And Yogi said, sure. And, you know, we all know, you know, Yogiisms, some were true and some weren't true. But I was there for this, that when Steve Jacobson gave him the ball and said, I'd like you to autograph it. And he said, I'd like you to autograph it with your full name, Lawrence Peter Berra. And so Yogi took the ball and he had the pen and he looked up quizzically at Steve and he said, I haven't written Lawrence Peter Berra in such a long time. I have forgotten how to spell it. And I was there when he said it. You know? So I believe in some of those Yogiisms, and I was around for a few others too, but he was real. He was real. But what a great, great player.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great player. And, you know, he's known for the Yogiisms and all the commercials, but, 10-time World Series champion. I mean, it's great player, great player. You know, you speak about Hack Wilson in this book in one of the articles. I heard of Hack Wilson, but never knew, you know, how he died so tragically and so young. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, he had that 56 home runs, which lasted a National League record for a long time. But he was an alcoholic, and he apparently just couldn't stop drinking. And he was a little. I mean, he was 5'6", but he was 5'6" tall and 5'6" wide, I think, as well. He was a great player. He succeeded, and he made the Hall of Fame. I guess they should have also an Alcoholics Hall of Fame, and in which he would be in. He was an important, especially Cub player. Yeah. Since I was a Cub fan, he was one of my idols.
Uh-huh. Ira, when you're putting a book like this together, and it's going over so many of your columns. And like you said, I had mentioned something that's in the book and you had forgotten it. Do you get nostalgic when you start to read your columns and, like I said, look back at your career?
Nostalgic. No, the thing is, as I said earlier, I don't know where I got the energy, but it was over a period of 50 years. So it wasn't exactly, like, you know, 24 hours a day. And I had, you know, I remember I was a fan of the writer E.B. White. We know E.B. White. And I was reading one of his book of essays, and I was going to Yankee Stadium, and I wasn't writing that day, but I just thought I'd just pick up something for the following day or the day after for a column. And I was walking. I lived on in 30th and First Avenue in Manhattan. So I was walking over to Park Avenue to get the subway. And as I'm walking, I still have this One Man's Meat by E.B. White. And I was reading one of the stories in it as I'm walking. And the writing was so good. And it was so depressing that I turned around, went back home, got in the bed and pulled a sheet over my head because it was so good. And, you know, in some ways you try to emulate, you know, the best, you know, the best that you can do. But I thought, oh my God, you know, I mean, this is really good stuff. And so I recommend One Man's Meat by E.B. White, a collection of his pieces. They ran in the New Yorker primarily. Yeah. But nostalgic about my own stuff. Some are just really happy memories with some of these people, and getting to know some, getting to be friends, friendly with them. So like Ted Williams or Carew, you know, or Tom Seaver, then writing for a newspaper syndicate, NEA, Newspaper Enterprise Association, and sometimes they would have a star athlete write a column once a week for a year. And they asked Seaver to do it, and he agreed. And I was a sports editor, and so I would write his column for him, and once a week. And then I would call, or he would call, and then we would talk. And then I would write the column, and then I would read it to him, you know, for any errors or whatever. But what, you know, he was a journalism major at USC. He didn't graduate, but I think until his junior year. And so one day he said to me, "Ira," he said, "I want to write the column myself. I'll do it myself." And I said, "Great, I don't have to do any work. Fine." And so he's supposed to be in at 4 o'clock. So now it's 3:30. He's not in. Now it's 3:45. He's not in. At 4 o'clock, I called him. I said, "Tom, where's the column?" And he said, I took a full scap paper to the library, and I sat down, and I wanted to write about Henry Aaron. He said, "Henry Aaron is my hero. He's just great. And I wanted to write a column about Henry Aaron and like the first time I faced him." And I got him out the first time. And the second time I threw the same pitch and he hit a home run. So, and he said, "I just want to write about that." But he said, "I got halfway down the page. The column is going to be about 700 words." He said, "I got down the page, which is like about 150 words." And he said, "And I didn't have anything more to say." He wasn't a professional writer. And so I said, "Tom, let's talk." And we got the column out. And so, but that was the one and only time that Seaver wanted to write the column himself.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your relationship with Tom Seaver, because I was born in 62, 1969. I was 7 years old, baseball fan, Mets, you know, love, and Tom Seaver is my favorite player. But you talk about a time where you took the train up to Rochester and sharing a guest bunk bed with Tom Seaver. I mean, that must have been something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was after a baseball writer's dinner in January 1970. The Mets had won the World Series, of course, and Seaver in five games. And Seaver was lost one game and won the other. But he was named Athlete of the Year in Rochester, where they're going to give the trophy. We left the baseball writer's dinner with Joe Louis and Kurt Bleffrey, and we took a cab and we got on the train. Seaver and I were going to share a compartment, and which is it has two beds, one on top of the other, but enough room to move around, but two bunk beds. I said, he said, "Well, who's going to sleep in the bottom bunk?" I said, "Well, I guess we have to flip for it." You know, I mean, I'm not going to give in to the MVP just because he's the MVP or the Cy Young winner. And so we flipped, he won. He got the bottom bunk. Okay, so I had to climb up on top. And that, and we slept in. And this was like around midnight. And then we had to get up at like into Rochester at 5 o'clock. And my bunk mate and I were bleary eyed. And then we got out and we were going to be picked up at the Rochester train station by some of the people who were running this organization where he was getting the trophy. When Kurt Bleffrey, who was kind of a jerk, but it was very cold. Even for it was January, and it was kind of cold, and it was rainy, a cold rain, and Seaver had forgotten his or overcoat at the hotel where the baseball writers' dinner was, and so now he was just in his sport jacket and he was kind of shivering, and Bleffrey took off his coat and draped it on Seaver's right shoulder to keep his pitching arm warm, and that was. That may have been the highlight of the trip for me, that moment, you know, and the whole thing. And then afterwards, Seaver and I, we were just friends. And he was a big gardener. And so one time in a weekend of the Hall of Fame at that weekend, and Friday night, they have like a little hors d'oeuvres for the Hall of Famers. And then the Hall of Fame is closed only to the Hall of Famers and the writers. And I introduced my wife, Dolly, to Seaver. And my wife, Dolly, likes stuff with plants and Seaver's crazy about gardening. And the two of them started talking about gardening. There wasn't a single word about throwing a baseball. So I left, let them talk to each other, you know, and they did. And that was Seaver was funny, and Seaver was a delight too. Oh my God, when he got that disease and that Lyme disease, and
yeah,
it killed him.
I saw something online where you were comparing, you know, your career, a major part of your life has been sports, and you compared sports with music, and I thought that was very interesting how the comparison between sports and music. Could you about that?
I wish I knew what I said. But you think about it. Look, what's more beautiful other than a Beethoven's ninth than a shortstop going into the hole and making that long throw across the first base and getting the runner by half a step? Da 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 da. You know, so yeah, there's the beauty and the music and the swing, you know, the pitcher and the wind up, all things have to meld. And it's like the tuba and the saxophone and the trumpet all coming together at one point. So, you know, you can see music analogies to it. And yeah, it was, you know, and the older I got, the more I appreciated baseball. I played baseball in high school, and I played basketball in high school and college as well. But in baseball, every year I learned something else into my old age, and the appreciation, you know. I mean, like I mentioned to you, the shortstop going into the hole. Most fans, or a lot of fans, I guess, want if you're for the team that's batting, you want that guy to get on first base. If you're rooting for the opposing, you know, the team that's in the field, you want that runner out. And so you're just rooting for the result, you know. Well, the older I got, the more I just rooted for that shortstop to get that ball, you know, make that backhand stab, you know, right himself and make that long throw across the infield. If you go out to a baseball field and you go out to shortstop, it's a long throw from the top of the outfield grass where the shortstop will play to first base. It's a long, hard throw. And having played, I did appreciate, you know, a lot of that. And I played first base my senior year in high school, and I was just in awe of Keith Hernandez, the way he played first base. I mean, he was it was balletic in the way Keith Hernandez played first base. As I said, as time got older, I hate the idea of these pitchers now only being able to pitch five innings or four innings. You know, then they take them out. You know how much fun it was to see Koufax and Holtzman pitching like a double no hitters. You know, but going nine innings. You know, I mean that was some of the treat of baseball, and we're missing something now with that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We're so grateful for your time. We could talk for hours with you. But the one thing that I saw at least mentioned once in the book, maybe more, is that people keep saying, you know, baseball's ending its popularity. You know, baseball is, you know, it's not going to be around any longer. There were things in the book that there were columns. And here we are, you know, years later, they are tinkering with the game. And, you know, I know your feelings from reading the book on some of those things, like ghost runners and pitch clocks and all those things. But one thing is, baseball is still persevering. And I'd just like to get your feelings on that.
It will. And you go to a ballpark and you see lots of kids running around watching the games. And, you know, we as fans took up fandom when we were children. Was it you? You said 7 years old, and mm-hmm. I was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And when my dad took me to the Yankee White Sox game in Comiskey Park, a doubleheader, and it started getting cold in the second game. And I said, "Dad, can we go home?" Yeah, it's going to be around. I mean, look, after the 1920 with the Black Sox, people thought baseball was finished, you know. And then when they started hitting home runs after the dead ball era, people thought, well, baseball's finished. You know, not who wants to go see people hit home runs? Well, Babe Ruth did. So it's and then in the late 60s, you know, the leading hitter in the American League was in 68 or 68 was Yastrzemski with 301. You know, and they lowered the mound so the pitchers wouldn't have as great an advantage. But so they'll change things. So they may go back to pitchers pitching nine innings one day. You know, every once in a while you see a pitcher pitching a nine inning game. You know, but there aren't that many Greg Maddoxes around anymore.
No,
who I loved.
Yeah, not at all. The book is called Baseball's Best Ever, Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers. I mean, you talk about Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Roberto Clemente, Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson. This goes on and on. So many great articles in this book. I have one last question. Which era of baseball did you enjoy the most? I mean, I'm right now I'm not really enjoying this type of era with the ghost runner and the time clock and the five innings of the pitcher and come the parade of relievers. I mean, I really like the 70s and 80s. What was your favorite era of baseball?
Well, I'll date myself, but I mean, that's an interesting question. And but every era had its pluses. But I think when I really got to understand baseball, starting when I was 10 years old, so it was 1950. So from 50, and then in Chicago, we had the Go-Go Sox and 50, 51, 52, and that created a lot of energy, a lot of interest. Then the Cubs were always just the Cubs, but Hank Sauer, you know, was belting home runs, and even though they were always fighting the Pirates for last place, Cubs, I would say the 50s, because it was all new stuff, and it was just so fresh and wonderful, and going to the games, sneaking into the games, and watching the play, and we could make fun of certain things like the Cubs double play combination, Terwilliger to Smalley to the grandstands, Mock to Smalley to the grandstands, and so we were prepared for any of it. Okay. Anyway, there you have it. So, well, the 50s, probably.
Ira, this book is fantastic. I recommend everybody go pick it up. Baseball's Best Ever, Half Century of Covering Hall of Famers. Ira, thank you very much for joining us on Baseball and Barbecue. We really appreciate it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ira. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you. I enjoyed it. The questions were great. And I appreciate the appreciation. And we have to thank my wife for setting this thing up, because I never would have done it myself.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Burkow.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast. And if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And we thank you, Ira, for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. Len, his stories are great. I mean, he shared a train car going up to Rochester with Tom Seaver.
How much would you have paid to take his place in that train car?
Oh, my God, yeah, really? Well, it would be a little strange, because Tom Seaver would have been 20-something and I'd be a little kid. That'd be a little, little strange.
We talk often. Just whether it's just you and me talking, whether we say it on the show. But one of the great things about doing this show is we get to speak to some incredible people. Definitely Ira Burkow. I mean, I read his stories all the time in the Times. The people that he interviewed, those stories that he told are just a snippet from that book.
Yep.
So highly recommend the book, please. It's not like he needs this. The sales from us, but just buy the book, please. You know what else, Jeff?
I know.
It's time for the Baseball Quote of the Week.
There are two theories on hitting a knuckleball. Unfortunately, neither of them works. That was Charlie Lau, who was a batting coach, I believe, for the Kansas City Royals.
Jeff, we want to tell everybody to go to baseballbbq.com. I was at your house for a barbecue for July 4th, which we did not mention.
You were at my house, but you did all the cooking.
But you had grilling tools and accessories from baseballbbq.com, and they were exceptional. Everybody should go to the website. Yeah, that was fun. And you had a great idea. You made some hot dogs.
Cut
them up.
I did.
And then we used some mustard sauce on them, some barbecue mustard sauce. It was exceptional. It was a good time. I hope everybody had a wonderful 4th of July. And I hope that some people used this gentleman's hot dogs. We met Ralph Perazzo at Pig Beach 2 years in a row. His products are exceptional. Another quote, which you're going to hear, I'm not going to ruin it. There's a quote in the interview, and I think everyone will agree that baseball and hot dogs go great together. So everyone, please listen to Ralph Perazzo, Snapperazzo Hot Dogs. Someone once said, it was actually Humphrey Bogart, a hot dog at the game beats roast beef at the Ritz. Hot dogs and baseball, it's been a perfect combination forever. Our guest has a passion for hot dogs. Call them Frankfurters, call them hot dogs. We'll find out what we should call them. But he makes an awesome dog. We know because we met him twice, actually, at Pig Beach at the Jeff Michener Foundation benefit. Our guest is Ralph Perazzo of Snapperazzo. Ralph, we are thrilled to welcome you and your incredible product to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it. I'm glad we're finally able to connect.
Yes, we are as well. Reading everything about you, you're actually from our area. You from New York and Long Island.
Yeah, born and raised.
And that's where you developed your passion for hot dogs?
I mean, my passion for sausage in general was from a young age. You know, I come from a 100% Italian family, so there was sausage always on the table at some sort of shape, right? Oh, I always tell people Rytex Kutis. He was the original sausage maker for a great book called The Great Book of Sausage Making. He was the original owner of sausagemaker.com, which is out in Buffalo, New York. It's been around for 50 years. purchased my first VHS tape to show my age from their website at like 15, 14 years old. And I was already making sausage at the house with family, you know, just doing basic stuff, you know, sweet Italian, hot Italian. And it kind of started from there. I've had an infatuation with hot dogs since I was a kid. You know, growing up in New York, going to Jewish delis and getting a great kosher dog, or going, you know, to the local butcher shop and getting a homemade one. You know, I was very fortunate to be around it. Even being a child and visiting my grandparents in Brooklyn and going down to Nathan's, you know, so hot dogs are very New York or very American. And back then it was a product that, you know, when you ate it, it was so like, how do I say this? It had such an impact. As a young child, you know, eating a great charred hot dog in the backyard, or getting that crispy, naturally cased hot dog from the sausage maker in town, you know, at my local Italian pork store or whatnot. So, you know, as I got older, I started working in the culinary industry as a chef. I was a cook at like 15, 16 years old, got my first gig, totally illegal, working at that age. But, you know, I met some great people and got pushed in the right direction to go to the Culinary Institute of America. And I'll never forget my first day of charcuterie. It was an amazing experience as I learned how to emulsify product at a certain temperature and learning difference between cold smoke, hot smoke, difference in casings and whatnot. And after that class, I was infatuated. You know, I bought a little 5-pound stuffer, a little smoker. I bought a real meat grinder. I actually still have my grandmother's meat grinder on the, get that for me, I'll show it to the guys. So I had a little meat grinder from my great grandmother that I used to use. My fiance's going to grab it for me that I still have to this day, which was my first meat grinder. You know, I remember buying a bigger, I don't know if you guys can see this, but this is my,
look at that.
My grandma's meat grinder.
Yeah.
It's kind of a personal heirloom, as they say.
Nice.
So, you know, as I got to culinary school, I was making sausage on the weekends and started working in a great restaurant called Jean George in New York City back in the heyday in like the late 90s. Chef Gabriel Gruther, who's a great chef, he's a very big guy in New York now, he saw my passion, and we used to get succulent pigs in all the time. And Chef Gabriel and Jean George would let me cut the cheeks out of the pigs. And I was like a squirrel. I would cut cheeks every week, got all the pigs coming in. And then I would freeze it all. And then once I got 4 or 5 pounds, I would take it home with me on the train and I'd make sausage that weekend. And that's when I learned how cheek fat is so amazing for sausage. The joke was Jean-Georges would walk into the walk-in, there'd be pigs hanging with all the cheeks missing, big holes in each side of the pig. So I owe a lot to Jean-Georges in that era of cooking, you know, getting cheek fat and quality pork fat back and things like that, and learning about, you know, quality pork and different cuts and taking it home and cooking. And I would actually bring the sausages I made to the kitchen to like give it to all the chefs to get approvals. You know, I was like a young cook looking up to them. A great Frenchman by Eric, name of Eric Hubert. He was a great pastry chef, dear friend, definitely one of the most inspirational people in my life. He had an infatuation with cured meats and, you know, would tell me, he was from Brittany, France, and he would tell me about the charcuterie in France. And you know, I would make different dry cured sausages and stuff, and I'd bring them in and we'd eat them during lunch or during when we were prepping or whatnot. And, you know, it kind of grew into a thing. You know, I always dreamed of having a sausage or a hot dog company. Fast forward my whole culinary career, working from every kind of restaurant you could think of to owning my own butcher shop and restaurant. And when COVID happened, it was kind of like a wake up call. I couldn't work in the restaurant. I was kind of forced to create something for an income. And I say it all the time. I was sitting in my apartment. My fiance is like, why don't you just make your hot dogs? Everybody loves your hot dogs. Because I used to make a lot of pork and beef hot dogs for culinary events because everybody would bring their caviar and their foie gras. And I was showing up with a quality hot dog and had a line at the event. So I kind of got known as the hot dog guy, go to the hot dog guy at these events. You know, it's a great story. I mean, I called some family friends in New York that have been in the meat cutting business for over 50 years, the Castellano family. They own Prime Foods Distributors in Long Island, New York. And the old man used to make the Nathans and the Sabrettes back in the 70s and 80s in his plant in Florida. I kind of sent them some samples of my own hot dogs that I made, and they kind of called me and said, you need to do this. that kind of gave me the ins and outs of it, how to look for a plant, you know, just the business side of manufacturing hot dogs. They don't do that anymore. So we shot for the stars, made about, I don't know, 100 to 200 pounds, drove around Las Vegas where I live now, and everyone was cooped up in their house with COVID. They called me the hot dog Santa. I was giving out free hot dogs all over Las Vegas. Me and my fiance, Bailey, we created a page on Facebook. And all we asked for was for people to leave comments and reviews. We got amazing feedback. And we did a second round. People were just ecstatic about it. And then we decided to do a pre-sale, completely illegal again, where we were going to do 1,000 pounds. And we took pre-orders. We put a page up and on Facebook, and basically we let people know about it on social. And we sold out of 1,000 pounds in less than 6 hours. Wow. We had to shut it down because we couldn't fulfill all the orders. And we were shipping people all over the country, FedEx too. So people were paying, you know, $100, $200 in shipping just to get 2 pounds of my hot dogs, you know? So that was kind of we had something here. People were waiting for it. After that, you know, we had a great chef friend of mine, Gino Bernardo. He's the chef of the Summit Club here in Las Vegas. It's a very prestigious golf course. He loved my hot dogs, dear friend from Jersey. He said, listen, I have, you know, Mark Davis, the owner of the Raiders. You know, he comes in here all the time. He loves hot dogs. He's like, get me some hot dogs. I want to put it in front of him. And pretty much Mark Davis came in. I still have the picture, I think, on Facebook, the original picture of Mark Davis holding my hot dogs. He served more hot dogs, and Mark Davis said, this is amazing. I love it. Let's get this guy in the stadium. And that pretty much was the kickstart of, right. Wow, you know, this is amazing. So when we were in the process of interviewing USDA meat plants to process our formulations and our recipes, you know, that was a big anchor, right? Hey, we got a spot in Raider Stadium that's opening brand new. Right. And the stadium wasn't even open yet. A lot more to tell, but that's kind of the quick version. You know, I don't know what questions you want to ask.
Yeah.
I just think it's amazing that, you know, just really just started a few years ago, and now you're in Alliance Stadium in Vegas. Any plans to grow into other stadiums, being the official hot dog of, you know, baseball, football, and whatnot?
So as you know, the hot dog industry is very large. There's a lot of big corporate companies that, you know, I'm not going to name the brands here, you know, that are owned by overseas companies like in China and some parts of the UK that are not really American brands anymore that are, you know, have the stronghold of the market. So we're still the small guy. If people want a quality high-end hot dog, I'm their guy. If they want a cheap, high-volume hot dog, I am not their guy, right? Because we're using quality whole muscle, naturally smoking, you know, we'll get into all that. But we have gotten into a couple of stadiums, Snapdragon Stadium in San Diego. We have two booths there. They buy our hot dogs. Just made the Musgrove dog for the Padres pitcher with Saquon Casino. So those people have reached out. We're talking with them. You know, the Reds, Cincinnati Reds, have brought in our product for their VIP suites. Very, very thankful for them. So, you know, we're slowly getting opportunities. We've had a couple of stadiums reach out for us to be the hot dog of their team, which we're working out. Nothing has been signed yet. In September, I'm coming to New York. We're cooking at Yankee Stadium, which I'm really excited about. Getting in front of the Steinbrenner family and hopefully getting a little booth there or something. You know, it's a dream of mine to be in Yankee Stadium. So, you know, for our stadium business, it's been 2 years with Allegiant Stadium, right? Two plus years. And we're slowly gaining traction in the sport world. Hot dogs are being noticed. People want a quality hot dog. You know, in Los Angeles, we do a lot of big business in Los Angeles. We were just in Forbes magazine. I don't know if you guys saw that. Bailey can send it to you. With Tale of the Pup, an iconic hot dog brand. They're doing so well with our products. And we made a custom dog for them that a local, very big baseball team noticed, and they did reach out to me, and they see that we're gaining ground in Los Angeles, and there may be some big opportunity there. So as we grow in the food service sales with our distributors nationally, the other sport arena opportunities seem to be coming in.
You know, you mentioned that you're very excited about going to Yankee Stadium, but you know, Citi Field is the stadium that has the better food options. That's been known here. So you might want to go to Citi Field, and you know, Yankees have plenty already. Come to Citi Field.
Hey, I'm from Long Island, love to be in the Mets too. You know, I wherever the opportunity lies, we're servicing an amazing Italian pork store in the Bronx, Calabria. Have you ever heard of Calabria Pork Store? They got the sausage chandelier. They're like grandfathered in. Oh, you guys gotta go. You gotta go. It's right on Arthur Avenue. It's been there for 45, 50 plus years. I walked in there when we were in the Bronx. This guy, Pete, he's one of the owners. You know, I was looking at all the sausage, and the first thing I said to him was like, you know, the health department doesn't break your horns with all this salami hanging, all this mold, you know? He starts laughing, and he's like, we're grandfathered in, which they are. It's one of the last places in the country that are allowed to do this. The dry cured sausage is just incredible. You know, we started talking sausage, and he's like, what do you do? And I was like, oh, I actually, you know, manufacture hot dogs, blah, blah, blah. Gave him my business card. We spoke the same language per se. And now he sells Snapperazzo hot dogs in his butcher shop, Italian Pork Store, on Arthur Avenue in the Bronx. So he constantly texts me and says, people are loving the hot dogs. They're incredible. We had a couple of Yankees come in. A lot of the Yankees go in there once in a while. We notice where our product, where people can grab it, is where we see the opportunities come in. Like our inbox for our website, we constantly get emails from people in the areas that our products being sold in food service. Like Sarge's Deli in Midtown, we make their hot dogs now. They promote it on their website. It's a 50-year-old iconic deli. The owners are great people. They just wanted a great hot dog. Hot dogs have changed since we were kids, right? I mean, there's different, they're definitely using different proteins, different product in it, different ingredients. You know, the same brands we ate 20, 30 years ago, or even 15 years ago, definitely don't taste the same. I don't know if you guys have noticed that.
No. Yeah. That's true. So Ralph, it's funny because I was going to ask you, I was going to say you're a New York boy, and yet where can I get your hot dogs in New York? But you're kind of answering it. I know that you know, because I saw like they're sold at Kroger's, but we don't have Kroger's here. So
we're growing. As far as New York, we don't have any retail sales except for places like that pork store I mentioned.
Right.
We're mostly in restaurants and bars at the moment, like Big Beach and places like that. Right. We're growing. We're in the Ritz-Carlton in Central Park South. That's crazy, right? We're in one of the most prestigious hotels in New York City. You know, Sarge's, you can go there and grab a hot dog. They're marketing it. We sell them our Beefy Butcher Dog, which is our new hot dog that's got no sugar, fresh onions and garlic, the first of its kind. We actually, when you eat the hot dog, you can see little pieces of fresh onion and garlic in the hot dog. We actually get the sweetness from the onions and garlic, where it's very hard to make a hot dog or a sausage without a little sugar. So I'm very proud of that product. That's a new product we launched. So, you know, I would say for you to get a dog quick, Sarge's Deli or the Pork Store or our e-commerce, or Greenport Brewing is a big supporter out in Long Island. He constantly is promoting it. Lucharitos, Mexican concept, they're bringing in a bunch of our dogs. We're kind of spread out between these bars and restaurants. A lot of great places in New York City. What's that hot dog concept that just opened up in Midtown? Lovely's is bringing it in. It's a great burger spot. So we just started distributing in New York. So we're constantly finding out who these customers are. And how it happens is people just tag us on social media, right? Mm-hmm. Had this amazing Snapperazzo hot dog at this restaurant or that restaurant. We try to keep up with it. You know, we're kind of in hot dog season as we say right now. So we're kind of completely swamped trying to keep up with all the distribution we have nationally.
Also, going back to your New York roots, before you were into the hot dog game, you had a restaurant that was very well known. Now, let's see. Yeah. It's BBDs, stands for Beers, Burgers, Desserts. And you got the New York City Wine and Food Festival 2015 Burger Bash winner.
Yeah.
And then did you move the restaurant to Vegas? Is that what happened?
So what happened was when we won that award, we were the first restaurant in Long Island to win that. It was really for the five boroughs, right? So there was some political stuff there. The hot dogs came from BBD's. we used to bring in whole swing cattle. What that means is we had a relationship with a very great ranch that would slaughter our steer and send us, you know, sides of beef, and we would break it down, you know, grind it for burgers, you know, cut the flat iron out, the steaks. We always would have prime quality beef trim laying around. And we also would bring in pigs and make sausage or whatnot, and we'd have pork scraps laying around. So our hot dogs, we have pictures of like DVDs Long Island where I was making hot dogs there in my little small 30-pound smoker in the back of the restaurant. So the hot dog formulation and actually some of the recipes came from BBDs. And when we did the events, we did the hot dogs. You know, we did an event with BBDs. We would serve hot dogs and burgers, but the hot dogs were the best because I was using all the trim, so it wasn't costing me a lot of money to go do this event and give away food for marketing. But when BBDs took off, we had a great run in New York. The location that we were at, it just wasn't the right place for BBDs to grow. So we got an amazing opportunity to come to Las Vegas with the brand. When we opened Las Vegas, we did it with a casino here in town, which was called Stations Casino. A great experience. We opened it up 3 times the size. Unfortunately, the hotel did not build a second tower or build more rooms where the foot traffic that was there didn't really fit the restaurant and the concept. We chose to move the restaurant to the Las Vegas Strip, where we were working with a couple of different hotels. And then pretty much COVID happened. And then when COVID happened, all bets were off. The whole deals were squashed, all bets were off. And that's when, you know, going back to what I said earlier, that's when the Snapperazzo, the hot dog venture really started.
And Ralph, what's this I hear about you pretending to be sick in school so your grandfather would come get you and then take you out to a nice Jewish deli?
So my grandfather Perazzo, he was, you know, an old school Italian guy, and he, you know, he always did what he wanted. And, you know, my parents both worked, and he was that grandpa that would, you know, pick me up from school and take me to the local deli and get a sandwich, or take me to the pork store because they all knew him. And then he would get, you know, all the cold cuts and whatnot, and we go to the house and make sandwiches. And that's my memories of him, and I cherish them. You know, there was times where I played sick at school, and then, you know, and tried to have them call my grandfather to pick me up. And he knew what he was doing. And, you know, it was kind of like our thing, you know. It's funny because, like, the school even knew after a while, you know, oh, hey, grandpa's here again. You know, Ralph's got a sore throat, you know, like. So I was very, very fortunate. You know, I believe chefs, you know, the ones that have a history of great grandparents or parents that were passionate about food or cooking, whatever nationality they are, whatever culture they come from, it all starts there, right? I mean, I was bringing supersada and prosciutto sandwiches and aged provolone in my lunchbox in fifth grade, thinking up the place when everybody had like Lunchables and whatever else. You know what I mean? So I was eating the good stuff at a very young age. And, you know, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, my great grandmother, she would make amazing fresh mozzarella, homemade wine. I mean, the sauce, everything, the whole Italian stick, as you know, that you would think you would get from an Italian family. And to this day, I still use some of their recipes. The whole idea of using fresh onion and garlic in my hot dog came from my grandfather, who used to save the ends of the onions and the trimmings of the garlic, and he would dehydrate them, and they would save them. And then after 6 months, they would rehydrate them and use them in sausage or use them in a salad. Like, they were very cost conscious, right? They were immigrants from Italy who came here, and they worked their butt off and created a family, and they knew how to save money. But doing that with the onions and garlic, dehydrating and then reconstituting it, kind of gave the protein and what they were making like a really strong flavor of that onion and garlic. I tell people, like, think about how White Castle, how they have slurries of onion, right? Same kind of thing. You know, if you're doing that, it's in a sausage or if it's in a burger or whatever, it's amazing how that little bit of a technique can influence a dish. So even though they weren't making hot dogs, there's a lot of inspiration from my grandparents and a lot of the sausage making that we do.
You know, Ralph, I've been looking at your website, which, by the way, it's snaporazzo.com. Spell it out just like it sounds, snaporazzo.com. And you've been getting such great press. I mean, you've been in Forbes several times. And I'm looking at the article about the Super Bowl foods. And just so happens, it was written by a former guest of ours, Larry Olmsted. And it's very, very complimentary of you, of Snaporazzo Dogs. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. You know, listen, I'm proud to say we don't have like this big marketing company. You know, I don't have a bankroll where people are calling people for me. This is all organic. You know, we don't have, you know, brokers all over the country selling our product. It's me, my fiance, my two dogs, you know, literally. You know, it's grown a lot. And we're very, very fortunate to get noticed. But the reality is when people eat it, they talk about it on social. We live in a different world, right? So we see stuff every day. We see people in Boston, Maine, Florida, Texas, Northern California, places where we're not even sending product yet, you know, ordering our hot dogs in e-commerce, eating them, and then posting these great things, making videos. This is how people are writing about it. Kroger has helped. You know, you mentioned Kroger earlier. We are in about 300 stores of Kroger with our skinless dogs, which are not on our website yet. But in those stores are in Colorado, Vegas, Utah, and New Mexico, right? So we're not really in New York, LA, Chicago, you know, the main states that are kind of like really the hot dog people, right? The people that are the places that are hot dog centric. So it all kind of goes together. Doing things like this, doing a simple podcast with great people like you who ate my hot dog and just wanted to have a conversation. You know, we try to make time for everyone. We're so thankful for people who appreciate a good hot dog. And I realize as I sit here and we had like three of the biggest months in our whole business. And it's been a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice for me and my fiance. And it's been amazing to see where it's going. And we're just trying to keep it where it's controllable and we can feed the masses in the way that we want to.
You know, you said simple podcast. We are anything but simple. All right, Ralph. Ralph, I mentioned in the intro, hot dog versus Frankfurter. And, you know, when I was a kid, that's when I remember calling it a Frankfurter as a kid. Now you don't hear that anymore. Is there a difference between a hot dog and a Frankfurter?
Well, you know, if you go to the good old Google or Wikipedia, you know, they're the same thing, right? But in Germany, you know, a pork and beef blended product was usually called a Frankfurter, right? And that can be up for argument. But honestly, they both mean the same thing, especially in America. I had a person post the other day that said a hot dog is not a sausage. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Hot dogs are definitely a sausage, right? It's one of the first sausages ever kind of created in a way. It's a peasant thing. So it's really about branding and what you want to call the product. Because listen, we call our land case products wieners, right? Because they're skinny, they're long, they're 6-to-1. They got a natural land casing on them. They're naturally smoked. A true wiener was encased and naturally smoked. You know, after years gone by, a lot of these skinless hot dogs started being called hot dogs. And wieners were wieners. Wieners were known to hang, right? All connected. Right? That was what we all thought wieners were, right? So it depends on part of the country you go in. It depends who you talk to. It's all subjective. You know, hot dogs are very regional and very subjective all over the country. I mean, I can tell you, we sell different products in all different parts of the country just because of what the people grew up on there. You know, like you guys are New York guys, right?
Yep.
You grew up on beef, right?
Absolutely.
You know, you didn't grow up on pork and beef. If you go up to New England, you go up to Maine, you go up to Connecticut area, they're pork and beef. You know, the Portuguese culture up in Boston, all pork and beef. You go to Chicago, clearly it's all beef, just like New York. So things are regional. Southern California, big Latino community, very pork and beef driven. So, you know, it's like, who makes the best hot dog? I always say, it depends who you talk to and where they're from.
Yeah, we've had on Meathead from AmazingRibs.com. He is an authority on the regional hot dogs. you know, how New York has their dirty water dogs and Chicago has their, you know, however they serve it and what the toppings are. It's fascinating to hear that, which makes me want to go to Nathan's in Coney Island. Everybody's been to Nathan's in Coney Island if you are from this area. What makes a Nathan's hot dog so good?
You know, I hate to burst your bubble, but Nathan's is not an American brand anymore. It's owned by a company in Wuhan, China.
Look
That's
at
a
that.
True story. If you want to Google it, if you want to Google it, it's on there. It's all public record. I think
it's Nathan's the name then.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you go to Nathan's Coney Island and get a hot dog, and then you go to Nathan's in the supermarket and buy a hot dog, and you eat them side by side, I don't think you're going to have the same product, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's about where you get a Nathan's hot dog, my personal opinion. I think what makes Nathan's so good is the nostalgic history of it. You know, people are drawn to that nostalgia. You know, we personally make hot dogs completely different than anywhere else for that reason. We want to create our own fan base, our own kids, nostalgia, people that grow up with our hot dogs. We listen to what people kind of want. And we kind of create things to them. You know, going back to the cooking method you were talking about in New York, like if you look at our website, our pork and beef naturally taste product, that's a dirty water dog. It's got a coarse grind. It's designed to be cooked in a dirty water with our seasoning packets and snappy, juicy. Now that dog, the emulsion is completely different than my beef dog. My beef dog that we launched the brand with, it's got a tighter emulsion where we recommend griddling that low and slow on some foil to let it naturally, you know, caramelize and get a Maillard reaction and, you know, that snappy, juicy, beefy hot dog. If you put that hot dog in water and cook it dirty, it will still be good, but it's not going to be as good as the pork and beef because of the way the emulsion is. Our beefy butcher dog, we designed it to be cooked in both fashions. It's good water, it's good grill, that's a whole different product. But, you know, we realize since we naturally smoke our product, we don't add any beef flavorings, we don't add any beef, or I don't know what it's called, but the artificial smoke or soy protein or gluten. I mean, there's so much that you see in some of these products that have just been accepted, and that's fine until people really know what it is. You know, that stuff creates a certain flavor, including MSG, right? So, you know, all those brands kind of have that product in it, hence why they have sub products that don't have that in there you see now on the shelf.
Well, you know, Ralph, when we had your hot dogs, and we've had them at the 2 years in a row, and the first year, I had never had a hot dog like that in my life. It was so good.
Oh, thank you so much.
So that when you were back that second time, I was like, Jeff, he's back. I was so excited. Now, I cannot imagine. I ate that hot dog and every bite, you know, not to be an ad for your hot dogs, but every bite was so good. Whereas Nathan's, when they do that hot dog eating contest, I could not see doing that with yours because they're not tasting these hot dogs. It's almost like they're wasting them. And yours have to be savored. So that is a big difference.
You know, hot dogs have a bad rap of being cheap products, right? Like if you go to our website, we put a video on there, me at the plant, grinding the product, mixing the product. We're showing you what we're doing, right? You try to do that at some other brand's plant, you're not going to be happy with what you're seeing. Probably going to look like some, you know, science project, you know, some slime or, you know, whatever. And the thing is their product, a lot of their products are aerated, they're stabilized. So that's why you can woof them down. They're pretty much light, airy, mushier product. When you ate my hot dog, you got that experience because you're eating whole muscle. You're eating a high protein product. You're not eating a emulsified, aerated, stabilized hot dog. You're eating true ground, high protein product. The levels of iron in our hot dog are probably higher than most in the industry, and that's what you go on to know how much protein is actually in the product. You know, and flavor, you know, it's one of those things. Like I call it the hot dog burp. Italians call it agita, right? When you eat a hot dog, you got it in your chest, right? My hot dogs, we see it all over online. My fiance is the queen of it. She's going to kill me that I'm saying this. It'll be late night. She'll eat two or three of them, you know, plain on a bun. And she said it, I don't know how many times over. Honey, I don't, it's not repeating on me. I don't have heartburn. I want to eat another one. Like, da da. So, like, that's our thing. Like, you can eat our hot dog and feel good about yourself. And when you eat the other stuff, your body is reacting to whatever's in that product. Right. And that's where your hot dog burps come from. A big part of it is we naturally smoke on maple wood. Not many people naturally smoke their hot dogs. I really don't know many brands that do. You know, it's a very expensive cost. There's more room for things to go wrong, right? Instead of just steaming and liquid smoking and dredging. And that's what separates us. I'll be honest, the only negative thing we've heard about our hot dogs over the last couple of years is some people felt that they were too smoky. And I looked into that and I was like, you know what? These people are from New York. These people are from Chicago. These people are from Milwaukee. You go to those cities and there's not really a real smoky hot dog. Guys in Texas, guys in Florida, guys in the Midwest, California, everywhere else in the country are like, best hot dog I've ever ate. Don't complain about the smoke. So hence why the Beefy Butcher, we made that with a lighter smoke, focused more on fresh onion and garlic, more of an East Coast, New York style hot dog. That is the hot dog that Sarge's is actually serving right now. We realized that we have to cater to everyone's palate, especially if we're going to be a national brand. So we've invested every dollar of our life savings into this, where it's like, you know, instead of going to buy a new house or a new car or something, we're kind of rolling it back in the business and building two new SKUs that are for the area that wants a less smoky hot dog, right? Or stadium that wants me to make a 3-to-1 jalapeno large 5.3 ounce dog for their stadium that is going to be a product that I could sell for the next 5-10 years. A lot drives what we do with what people are looking for and getting. And I think that hot dogs skip the generation. I really do. I think the younger generation just doesn't really care about hot dogs per se until they have a product like ours, I'm proud to say. Education is everything. But the best is when I have older people who say, I haven't had a hot... We were in a golf outing at Saquon Casino, one of our casino clients. We had this gentleman, he was in his late 60s, come up to me and said, I haven't eaten a hot dog in 25 years. He's like, and that's one of the best hot dogs I've had in my life. And I looked at him, I'm like, come on. He's like, I'm being dead serious. He's like, everyone told me on the course, it was on a golf course, I got to come to this hole and try this hot dog. So when we get stuff like that, we know we're doing something right. And also from what you're saying.
Ralph, we greatly appreciate your time. We're so glad that you were able to, you know, that we were finally able to make this happen. But I have two more for you. First,
sure.
It's I'm sure it's an advertising ploy or whatever, but, and I won't mention the brand, but growing up, there was a hot dog and their commercial was that they plump when you cook them. And they even had, I remember a commercial where it was the barbecue lid was closed and all of a sudden it would dent the lid. You'd see bang, bang, you know. What was the point of that? Do we want a hot dog that plumps when we cook it?
Oh, man, you're putting me in the fire right now.
Oh, I don't mean to, but, you know.
I'll say this. So you know how hot dogs are sized, you know, 3-to-1, 5-to-1. You know what that means, right? So 3-to-1's 3 to a pound, 5-to-1's 5 to a pound.
Okay.
Right? And so on and so on. So when we go, let's say we go against a brand that you're mentioning or a brand like Nathan's per se, they'll have the customer will be buying their 4-to-1 hot dog. So that means they get 4 hot dogs to a pound. I'll show up with my 5-to-1 hot dog, which should be smaller, right? When I do it, I show up, we take a raw weight on a scale, we cook the product exactly the same, and we take that product, we put it back on the scale cooked so they can see the loss of weight from the cooking. Then I stick it in a bun and I put it in front of them, right? When they look at it, they're like, how is your hot dog the same size as the 4-1 and yours is a 5-1. And I look him dead in the face and I say, mine is a whole muscle product. This is, you know, trimmed, stabilized, whatever this brand puts in their product, which shrinks. And this is, these are facts. So plumping, right? We don't have to get plump because we're using whole muscle. The plumping aspect is there to be a marketing tool to sell their product that is bigger and better and all that. I don't think people buy that anymore. And now when they see they can buy a premier product like mine and get an extra hot dog per pound, right? And it's eats better, almost the same size, and, you know, compared to the other one, it speaks volumes.
I figured that. And last, as I said, delicious hot dogs, and you're growing. But do you ever consider, and what do you do to avoid the you know, falling into that trap of getting too big, where your product, you know, that fine line where your product, you can't supervise it as well, or you don't want it to suffer because you've now gotten so big? How do you keep that under check?
Well, we work directly with a small meat plant, family owned, great family, great people. We have a good relationship. They process all our formulas. As we've grown, we've worked with them to let them know, you know, how we're going up in business. I control who buys our product. So when a distributor, US Foods, Sysco, people like that, buy our products, they have to purchase it through me, right? So it's a hands-on experience. So if there's a customer like Pig Beast says, hey, we really want your this hot dog, that hot dog, they put me in touch with their distributor. I speak to them directly. We set it up with them. They cut me a purchase order. I ship them direct the product, usually a pallet or two to start. That is what's been able for us to control where it goes, who we sell it to, and where our brand is. I will say that, you know, we've had some experiences where, you know, people have bought our product and put it on a roller grill with a different brand, and they said it was that brand and it was ours. And it wasn't theirs. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. You know, that's the distributor doing that. So as we grow, I would say every 100,000 pounds more, we try to, per year, we try to control our distributors, how many distributors have our product per state. We make sure our client base fits our brand. We're not just going out trying to sell to anyone, right? We actually turn people down sometimes, just because their branding, their style of place doesn't really fit our product and it just wouldn't work. That's how we control it now. As far as on a plant level, you know, it's a work in progress. I mean, anything that goes up in manufacturing, you have to adjust. You know, you have to adjust everything from your meat buy to your labor to your, you know, buying of certain casings that we use and just keeping up with, you know, materials and what's going on in the industry, you know, everything has to be attended to. So we take our time. We don't force things. You know, as much as we have grown, we did it gradually, you know, and we knew we were going to be in, for example, in three distributors in New York. We knew what products we were sending there. We knew Pig Beach, for example, was serving our lamb case products. And people were loving them. And then all of a sudden we said, you know what? The ingredients for these two items, we need to up this in the next 2 months because there's going to be a lot of people that go to Pig Beach, have this hot dog, and whether they're another bar, another restaurant, they're going to reach out. So controlling where everything goes is the main key. And then from there, we have an idea of what items to invest in to buy more of. Does that make sense for material purposes?
We thank you for coming on. If you could tell everyone how, if they're not near one of the places that has your hot dogs, how does somebody that's listened to this and is now salivating and has to have your hot dogs, how do they get them?
Our best way is through e-commerce on our website. We have two lamb case products on there that are the two hot dogs we started the brand on. Those, actually, you tasted those at Pig Beach. That's the best way for now. We're still a small company. We're trying to get better shipping, you know, with FedEx and whatnot. You know, we try to do our best with that. that is the best way, because we were able to send nationally through FedEx.
And I just want to point out to go to the website, snapperazzo.com. They have the whole page of testimonials. I'm just going to read one. And I quote, "A hot dog that tastes great is one thing. A hot dog that tastes great and doesn't give you agita is another." Somebody named Regina Bonello. I don't know if you know her or not, but that's a pretty good review.
That, you know what? That's kind of amazing you picked that one out of all those. That was actually my sister who passed away about a year and a half ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay. That's okay. No, that was a true statement from her, which had to be on the website. So, yeah, all those statements are from those people. We have a lot more. We just haven't updated them. Look, it's like people like yourself, when they eat it, it makes them think like, wow, you know, this is something totally different, you know, and we pride ourselves on that.
Mm-hmm. No. Ralph, we thank you for joining us on Baseball and BBQ. Get the great hot dog. You're on Facebook and you're on what other social media? You're on Instagram.
Instagram.
Thank you very much. Go to snapperazzo.com. Check it out. Order the hot dogs. It's fantastic. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you very much, Ralph.
Thank you so much, guys. Talk soon.
Thank you very much, Ralph. I'm glad that we finally got him on. You know, Jeff, everybody thinks that, I wouldn't say everybody, but, you know, there's hot dogs and then there's hot dogs.
Right.
And he makes a really good hot dog.
He does. And, you know, he's explained in the interview, you know, his process and how he does it. And it's really good hot dogs.
Yeah, it's almost like, I guess it's sort of like getting a piece of a steak that's just like low grade steak and then getting a real prime grade of steak. That's the difference with his hot dogs. We want to thank Ralph Perazzo. We want to thank Ira Burkow. And I want to thank you, Jeff.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, thank you.
And you are welcome. And I want to tell everybody that we are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts.
And I just want to remind everybody, if they want to get in touch with us, give us a call at 516-855-8214. Email us at baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Make a comment on our Facebook page. We have a Twitter at baseballandbbq. Instagram, baseballandbarbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. And by the way, photos of our barbecue were posted up there the other day, so check those out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, comment, subscribe, do all that fun stuff.
Tell your friends.
Yes, tell your friends.
And as I said, I'll say it again. We are brought to you by Bet Online. It is where the game starts. But Jeff, I don't have an issue with ending the podcast, because with two great guests, Ira Burkow and Ralph Perazzo, I think we could just drop the mic and call it an episode.
And we end with the poet,
Shel Krakowski.
And the musician,
Dave Dresser.
And the song,
Baseball Always Brings You Home.
And we'll see you next week.